Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Manual Therapy Blog. I am your host, Matt Thomason. And this is where we get to do multiple different interviews of well-known people and some lesser-known people within the world of physical therapy specific to manual therapy. And one of my goals for this is really just to learn as much as we can from experienced clinicians or experienced physical therapists that have come before us. And part of that is a little selfishness on my part because I want to learn as much as I can from some of these people that I get to interview for the blog. And unfortunately, I'm not able to attend, every class that I might want to or get to go to every conference that I want to and hear these people speak. Or I just don't have the relationship with them to call them up and, pester them about certain things that I would like to learn about. So with that, we get to do many different interviews and speak with some of these physical therapists, and I hope that you listeners out there really get to appreciate that and give you some content that is beneficial for either your professional life or even your personal life in some way that can help either point you in the right direction or provide you some guidance or wisdom to how other people have done things in their lifetime or their clinical lifetime. That way it can benefit you in some particular way, whatever way that might be. One of the fun things we get to do today is speak with Joe Farrell. And instead of kind of giving you my little spiel about who Joe Farrell is, there's a very nice write-up with the program that he's affiliated with in Kaiser Permanente here in California. And I'm just going to read to you really quickly off of that website. And it goes, quote, "Joe's influence in the profession as a clinician, teacher, researcher, and advocate spans over 35 years. He is recognized as one of the pioneers of evidence-based treatment in orthopedics and manual therapy in the U.S. and played a critical role in the development and promotion of the American Academy of Orthopedic Manual Physical Therapists, where he was a founding fellow and first national president. Joe has been honored for his contributions to the profession on numerous occasions, including most recently as the Distinguished Lecturer Award from the AAOMPT, and the 2015 Catherine Worthingham Fellow by the American Physical Therapy Association. Joe has been on faculty at Kaiser since 1984 and also runs his own successful private practice. He received his degrees from the Illinois State University, Northwestern University Physical Therapy School, Curtin University of Technology, Perth, Australia, and Massachusetts General Hospital Institute of Health Professions." End quote. In our conversation with Joe, you'll learn that he is recently retired this past year and enjoying retirement life, but he is still very active within the profession and just recently made a large gift with his wife political advocacy affairs within the association. So he's still very active professionally, and if you are able to attend conferences or other things that he might be at, he is very giving. He's a very giving individual with his time and information and knowledge. So that's one of the first things you'll learn when you hear this interview is he's a giver. He has a lot to convey in terms of wisdom, and I hope you guys really get, if nothing else, you get that out of our conversation with him. One of the things early on in this interview, or just kind of a little bit of feedback on the conversation, but that goes away after a handful of minutes. And Joe and I really get to talk about a lot of fun different things. And he even gives his contact information. If people want to get in touch with him, he gives us his email address. So wonderful man, wonderful person to sit down and speak with, and hope you guys enjoy the interview as much as I did. As always, if you have any questions that come about from this interview, or if there are things that you want to hear from my conversations with previous guests or up-and-coming interviews or guests, please let me know. You know, I'd love to get suggestions or pieces of information that you'd like to learn about or hear from our guests on the blog and the podcast. So without further ado, please welcome Joe Farrell. For joining us again today, we're speaking with Joe Farrell. Joe is a physical therapist and is actually one of the founding members of the American Academy of Orthopedic Manual Physical Therapists. Joe, thanks for coming.
You bet. It's a pleasure, Matt.
Joe, before we get into too many different details, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, where would you like me to start?
Well, tell us. Where you're from, where you grew up?
Well, I grew up in Park Forest, Illinois, and that's in the southeast suburbs of Chicago. And I don't know how much detail. I went to undergrad school at Illinois State University on a gymnastics scholarship and got a degree in education, and then I went up to Northwestern University, got a certificate in physical therapy, and a long time ago, 40 years ago, 1976. And started my career in Boston, where I met my wife at Mass General Hospital. We're both physical therapists, and I had two mentors there that were just awesome. One was from Sydney, Australia, and the other from U.S., but they'd both done some work with Jeffrey Maitland, and they convinced me to apply to the postgraduate diploma in manipulative therapy in Perth and Adelaide, and I chose to go to Perth, mainly because I didn't get into the one course in Adelaide. So I spent a year advanced training in manipulative therapy, and then stayed another 2 years and did some research with Dr. Lance Toomey.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, I could talk too long, but we got back in the States, spent a couple of years in South Bend. I moved to California. I was recruited to be a faculty member at the Kaiser Manual Therapy, at that time called Residency Program, Orthopedic Manual Therapy. And that was 1984. Been there since. Now I'm a senior clinical faculty in the fellowship program. Mm-hmm. My wife and I had a physical therapist for 30 years. And I just retired from patient care last December 1st and continue to teach and mentor on what we now call the Northern California Kaiser Orthopedic Manual Physical Therapy Fellowship Program. That's a mouthful. So that's kind of where I'm at now, and that's how I got involved with the manual therapy arena. It's kind of a little bit about me. Continuing my work with the Kaiser faculty. Mm-hmm. Doing some research with some other people currently, so it's not like I'm doing nothing. I do more than play golf and hike, you know, and ride my bikes.
Well, congrats on semi-retirement, I guess.
That's what you could call it.
Yeah. Well, so you're originally from Illinois, and you were doing gymnastics in undergrad, right?
Correct.
How did you get interested in physical therapy?
Well, kind of two individuals really influenced me. In the summer times, I trained at a gymnastic camp in northern Michigan, or on the south, still on the regular lower part of Michigan near Traverse City. And a couple of the guys I trained with for pre-physical therapy programs at the University of Iowa, and we got talking about, well, am I going to be in a, you know, get my degree in education, which I did get, or and be a teacher and coach, or am I going to, you know, pursue a career and, you know, another career? And so that's how I got interested in physical therapy. And then my high school gymnastic coach, one of them, believe it or not, retired from coaching after 5 years and went to physical therapy school. And that really kind of influenced me. He went to the University of Illinois at Chicago Circle. And, you know, just a couple guys from the University of Iowa and then my former coach, Rick Phoebe, really influenced me to go into the profession. And, well, I'm glad I did. I'm not thinking twice about it. It's been a great profession.
Great, right. Now, just as an aside, what were your events in gymnastics that you did?
In college ranks, I was a parallel bars specialist.
Wow.
So at that time, you could still specialize in one event. I wasn't good enough to make the team on the all-around competition, you know, the six Olympic events. But mm-hmm. I was fortunate enough. I did compete in the NCAA final Division I twice when I was there. And co-captain of the team for 3 years. So I had a good gymnastic career. I think it really gave me a lot of insight on how to prepare for high-level competition.
Mm-hmm.
I think that really helped me out in terms of starting and keeping a pretty busy private practice going and things of that sort over the years. I thought my gymnastic training was invaluable.
Great. Yeah, well, I was curious because you speak to some people and they tell you the reason they got into physical therapy was because as an athlete, they hurt themselves and that's how they learn about physical therapy was the rehab side. So I was just curious to know, but you answered that question, you know, already.
I was pretty lucky. I never really had any serious injuries.
Yeah.
Except a dislocated finger here and there. But one thing I did was interesting. You would go to training room and get ice for wrists and knees and ankles and things like that. And athletic trainers, that did influence me. But, you know, back in 70 to 74 when I was competing, we didn't have physical therapists in the training room. And I'm a place, which I'm pretty happy about.
And you mentioned earlier when you were in Boston, a colleague encouraged you to participate in the Maitland system, I guess. Is that right?
Yeah, you know, back when I was at Northwestern, we had three, I think there were 15-week internships. And the last internship I did was at Mass General.
Mm.
And one of my PNF instructors, Pat Sullivan, strongly encouraged me to go to Mass General for my last affiliation, not only to learn a lot about medicine, but to be immersed in PNF. And then she said there's a couple really good manual therapists, which the term was really not used that much back in 1976.
Yeah.
Well, you know, potentially could be great mentors of yours. And I was lucky. I had this lady, Jenny Green, who was from Sydney, who was a great physical therapist. And I remember after the first week of her mentoring me at Mass General, I knew this before I went in to the last affiliation. I go, God, I got an awful lot to learn. And Jenny was gracious. And, you know, one of the things she said to me right up front, she goes, you know, 10 years from now, you're going to be pretty comfortable with what you do, but you need to make sure that you get great clinical experience. You need to get some more advanced training. You're just being 18 months at Northwestern, it's not enough. And
yeah. So
she's talking about the programs in Australia, and then supervisor Tom Holland, he had taken Jeff Maitland's 3-month course in Adelaide.
Mm-hmm.
So between the two of them, after I was there a couple of years, they really programs in Australia. And back then, there were no other programs in the United States. Your choice was to go to Norway and learn the Kaltenborn Evjet system, mm-hmm. or go to Australia and learn the Maitland system. So I was fortunate enough to go to Australia.
Yeah, I'm sure your wife didn't mind going to Australia either.
Yeah, about a month before I found out I was accepted into the Perth Postgrad Diploma Manipulative Therapy Program at Curtin University, my wife and I got engaged.
Wow.
And I go, I don't think I'm going to go. I don't, you know, I'm madly in love with this lady, and she is a physical therapist also. She goes, you got to go. This is career changing. There's no way. I'm not going to marry you unless you go.
Wow.
So very unfortunate. And so I was over there for almost a year doing the first part of the manip therapy program. And then she came over and we got married in Perth in December of 1979. Then we stayed another almost 2 years after that while I did my master's degree, and she worked at Curtin University on the faculty.
Wow, so, that's pretty special.
Yeah, it really is. Actually, I'm going back to Perth in November this year. I was invited back by the university. They're celebrating their 50th anniversary. And I was the first postgrad diploma manipulative therapy student to get a master's of applied science. So I'm speaking at this event, and Dr. Peter Sullivan is going to be speaking. He was the first doctor PhD student. And then Dr. Lance Toomey, who was the mentor for both Peter and I, mm-hmm. is also speaking. And I think one other person. So it's going to be a real special event. I can't wait to get back and see a lot of my colleagues and friends down there.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things I was wondering as you're talking is you had some very influential people earlier on in your career that helped kind of somewhat influence you of where you ended up. What was it specifically about the Australian approach that attracted you?
Well, as I stated earlier, Matt, the two individuals that I worked with at Mass General,
mm-hmm. yes,
they really instilled some of the concepts that the Australian and Maitland people espoused. And one was communication, and two was pretty meticulous physical exam. And thirdly was the concept of treat, assess, improve your thinking. And I really liked that. And, you know, back then, everything was biomechanical. Mm. You know, if and this and that. And I liked the Maitland, his concept of the permeable brick wall. You know, on one side of the wall, you know, we've got the research and anatomy and physiology and biomechanics. And then we have the patient's story, the, you know, their signs and symptoms, as he called it. Now we call them, you know, symptoms and impairments. And I like that concept because Jenny and Tom, my mentors at Mass General, pointed out, you know, it's like often the biomechanical fault is not the pain generator. And that really impacted me early in my career. Mm. So I think that's kind of like why I wanted to go down there. I have a grandfather and grandmother. My mother's parents were from Kristiansand, Norway. So you'd think I'd want to go to Norway. In subsequent years, I've connected with a ton of my relatives in Oslo and Kristiansand. My dad's family was from Ireland, and I don't know much about them. But I don't know, just the Australian thought process of clinical reasoning, even back in the mid-70s, was really appealing to me, and that's why I went down there.
Okay, great. Yeah, that actually kind of illuminates a little bit of a different kind of question I had. Was some people that may not be in the world of manual therapy or even in the world of physical therapy, they hear the term manual therapy, and they may think, oh, it's mainly massage, or it's, you know, joint manipulation or joint mobilization. But I really like what you had to say about the clinical reasoning side and and the assessment and what made that unique for you that attracted that approach to you, or that attracted you to that approach.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting now, I've got 4 decades of experience in the, you know, as a clinician, and I truly, Matt, I probably would have retired early in the career if I didn't have this training in Australia, in Perth, and I'm indebted to not only Dr. Lance Toomey there, but two of my mentors there, Brian Edwards and Bob Elvey, who are unfortunately passed away in the last few years.
Yeah,
but they were really influential, very giving people. I spent hours upon hours after I finished my first year of manipulative therapy training in Perth with Brian Edwards at his clinic and Bob Elvey. And they're so generous with their time. Great men and great families too. So I was very, very fortunate to latch on to these type of mentors.
So how were they influential to you? I mean, they sound like they were really great guys and very giving, like you said, but any other specifics of why they were so influential to you?
Well, I think it wasn't just, well, from the physical manual therapy point of view, they were excellent clinicians. And I, observing them and co-treating with them at times, the way they connected with their patients was very, very fascinating. And they were very skillful at focusing their interview and physical examinations and their handling skills in terms of softness, gentleness, finesse was quite phenomenal. And that's never left me. And what I'm fearful of in our profession now, probably getting into a political time bomb here, but, you know, there's a lot of research out there that has said, well, the reliability and the validity of for movement testing is not very high. And I've come across some clinicians in our country that say, well, it's no need to palpate.
Yeah.
And then now everyone's trying to redefine palpation and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, there's 4 or 5 aspects of palpation that's very important. And it's only one component of the physical exam. There's so many other aspects of the physical exam that we utilize to prove our thinking as to what we think is the patient's main concerns and issues and how we're going to tackle them. Mm-hmm. And that goes back to this clinical reasoning and clinical thinking aspect of the Australian approach, which now really, I think, has permeated almost every other quote-unquote manual therapy approach in the world, which I think is quite fascinating.
Yeah. I can say for myself, in the fellowship program that I went through with Greg Johnson and Institute of Physical Art.
All right.
Before you get there, he tells you some, he asks you to read some things and as preparation, and one of the things that he asks us to read is the communication and the interview chapter out of Maitland's book.
Uh-huh.
And doesn't matter how much experience or how little experience or however good of a clinician you are coming into the program, every single fellow in training gets mentored on the interview, the subjective, the history, the interaction with the patient, all of it. So that's pretty nice to hear you say those things, because I feel like a little weight's off my shoulders, like, okay.
Yeah. Well, I think, and I've known Greg for probably 35 years. We're pretty close friends.
Yeah.
And, you know, Greg's one of the premier teachers in the world. And also, he and Vicky, I think, really believe in the art of palpation.
Well,
that's a really important part of our craft, Matt, that I just hope in my lifetime we don't lose that art form.
And that's exactly what I was going to say. It is an art form, and I mean, in my young career, I see similar, or I hear similar things to what you're saying, that you don't need to be specific, or you can't feel that, you know, and it's like, well, okay, well,
yeah,
you do what you want to do, I'll do what I want to do, and we'll see how the patient does. But
well, that's the bottom line is, well, what kind of patient outcomes are you getting? And that's, to me, the bottom line. You know, it's, you're getting them back to work, you're getting them back to sport, you're getting them back to life.
Yeah.
That's what we're about, right?
Exactly. You mentioned earlier, I don't know if it was just a mix-up in terms, but you did say 4 to 5 aspects of palpation.
Well, you know, you think about when we palpate any body part. You want me to kind of clarify what I meant by that, or?
Oh, please, because I'm very interested in improving palpation skills in any way possible.
Yeah, well, you know, I look at the first component of palpation as a, let's say we're looking at a lower back problem. I mean, I scan the whole spine. Part of it is observation, and then getting a very concise feel of the soft tissues, you know, going from superficial to deep.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean deep is down to where we think the facet joints and transverse processes are, and this and that. And then we'd look at bony alignment,
mm-hmm.
You know, feeling for any curves in the spine, and also, you know, what's the space differentials between spinous processes, for example. So that's like third or fourth. And then the last part is really two more parts I look at in palpation is accessory movements, passive accessory movements,
mm-hmm.
of the spine, and then passive physiological movement testing as needed. So I guess that's almost 5 aspects of the palpatory sequence that I've learned over the years, and I think that it's really important. I mean, I can just remember seeing, I used to see a lot of chronic pain. You know, I've just been retired from patient care since December of 2016, but I remember over the years, and even when I'm mentoring on the fellowship, hearing patients comment, man, no one's ever talk to me like this. And I'm sure you've heard this too, Matt, in your career, because you've had. And then they go, well, you know, no one ever touched me. Mm-hmm. No one went into the detail in the physical exam to find out what movements made me feel better, what made me feel worse. And then, you know, you hear these people go, wow, there's a lot of more to physical therapy than I thought.
Yeah.
And that's a product of, in my opinion, fellowship training that I had early in my career and you've had in your career. And I think it's why, you know, the manual therapy, AAO and PT was started, you know, 25, 26 years ago. Was, you know, we thought that entry-level education back in 1991 was not adequate enough to meet the needs of the patient population.
Yeah.
And, you know, the rest has been history.
Well, I'm glad that you brought up that early time in the academy. Can you tell us, because you're one of the founding members of it, can you tell us in those days what was going on? Because I wasn't around in those days in my professional career, in terms of what made you guys want to start the academy, and how did you get mixed into it with everybody else?
Well, back in 91... Dr. Freddie Kaltenborn,
mm-hmm.
and Dr. Jane Walters, who is the chairman of Oakland University's School of Physical Therapy in Rochester Hills, Michigan, got together because Freddie had done a lot of mentoring there, and one of their faculty, Dr. Cornelia Kulig, was on
faculty.
Yeah. And, you know, Jane and Freddie, you know, they said, you know, we need to get together with, there's other manual therapy programs in the country. So, you know, they invited Kaiser Permanente, which I was a faculty member on, And then our director at the time, Carol Jo Titchener, really spoke to me in detail and asked me to represent the Kaiser program. And I did. And other founding members were Dick Earhart from University of Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. Bjorn Munson had his own clinic and residency program. And I think it was through St. Andrews University in Michigan. Mike Rogers was independent. He was Norwegian trained. He was in Gulfport, Mississippi. And Ola Grimsby, who had the Ola Grimsby Institute. Michael Moore, who had a program in Folsom, California. And then I think last but not least, Stanley Paris, who I think at that time had not started the University of St. Augustine. But we all had residency programs. So we all came together at the urging of Jane and Walter, who at the time was vice president of the APTA, and Freddie, Dr. Colton Bourne, and we met for like 2 full days. And at the end of the first day, we said, you know, we want to work together. I mean, we want to be a team here. And I was chosen to be the first president at that meeting of the academy. You know, we called it an ad hoc presidency. It was just the eight of us. And Dick Earhart was the VP, vice president. I believe Ola Grimsby was the secretary. And I can't remember. No, I'm sorry. Michael Morrow was the secretary, and Ola Grimsby was the treasurer. And then Stan Paris was chosen at what we call member at large. And from there, that's how the academy evolved. And, you know, what was really cool about it is that we had 8 individuals that were willing to put away their personal bias, their personal financial gain. And, you know, to fund the academy, we all threw $500 in the pot from our own pockets.
Wow.
And back in 1991, $500 was a lot of money.
Yeah.
And that was our seed money. Probably for the first, well, I was president for 6 years, and those were the days we didn't have email. The most sophisticated communication was fax and phone.
Yeah.
So those were days we'd pick up the phone, we'd call each other. And a lot of people don't know this, but we paid our own way to meetings and our own food, our own airfare, you name it. And, so that's the dedication of that 8 of the founding members, of which I'm very proud to have been part of that, and still have very strong, enduring friendships with all those founders.
I love hearing that kind of stuff, Joe. At that time, when you guys were founding the Academy, what was your main goal and purpose for that? Just advancing the world of orthopedic manual physical therapy and the training in it? Or
yeah, that was the main thrust, but we also wanted to gain entrance into the International Federation of Manipulative Therapists, so thus represent the U.S. The spokes group or people for IFOMP. So the other thing, it was to improve the clinical education in entry-level physical therapists throughout the country. And the third thing was to find or create an accreditation body to accredit residency programs, we called them back then. Mm-hmm. And the idea was that we needed some external body to ensure standards of clinical instruction and competency. And even back then in 91, 92, we were accepted into IFOMP in 92. That could be a real long story. I don't want to take too much of your time.
It's okay.
But, you know, we really thought that we had to sell ourselves to the APTA, because APTA was really leery of these 8 of us, because, you know, 6 out of the 8 had their own kind of private residency programs, and there was this notion that they thought, oh, they just, people wanted to just make a bunch of money, and they didn't understand that at the time, they eventually did, the depth and the passion from which we wanted to improve clinical education. And we really were strong believers in accreditation of programs. And look, today we have a pretty strong accrediting body through the APTA. That there's 256 residency programs accredited and 43 fellowships accredited in all specialty areas of physical therapy, not just manual therapy and orthopedics and sports. It's quite phenomenal when you look back historically of. And I like to give my colleagues, the founding members, a strong endorsement, because we all really were, I think, pretty forward-thinking and knew politically, I knew as the president, that we couldn't just do manual therapy. It had to be a professional-wide movement. I think that worked. And we look at it today, and it's worked.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think quite so.
Yeah.
Well, good. That's one of the reasons why I want to interview all the founding members eventually, because I love hearing history, and I hope listeners do too as much as I do. So it's great to get some of those tidbits from you.
Sure.
Joe, moving a little bit away from that, I have some standard things I usually ask people. Given how long that you've been a PT and the fact that you were in practice for so long and that you're still in the educating realm of other clinicians, what still excites you about working with patients or working with and training other PTs? Anything in particular?
Yes, a few things. I really look at training other clinicians almost like treating a patient, in that the mentoring process, you have to develop a relationship with that mentee. And we'll just call them mentees, whether they're fellows or or res training. And I think that the relationships that I developed, I treasured over the last, I've been with the Kaiser program 34 years now. And like I said earlier in our interview, I had some really great mentors to model. And you learn over the years, it's kind of like when you treat patients, if you don't reassess yourself and self-analyze, you're not going to get really good at what you do. And, you know, we know the clinical experts are very good at self-analysis, self-critique, and trying to think about, like, okay, now why didn't I get that patient better when I got someone similarly, who presented similarly, back to playing golf, for example? And I think that's the same challenge you have working with mentees, is that you develop that relationship, you have to analyze, do an educational diagnostic analyzation of where they are as a clinician, as a person, where they are in the process of learning and their ladder, climbing the ladder of expertise. And I love that. I think it's a challenge that keeps me excited. And, you know, I have people I've mentored over the years that 25 years ago, even I might hear from someone, hey, well, what do you think of this? I'm doing this in my practice, and I'm wondering if I'm heading down the right track, or I'm having trouble with this patient. And I enjoy that kind of mentoring, and it all starts with that relationship you develop from the first day you meet them. And that's what excites me now.
Cool. Good.
Yeah.
So for the younger clinicians that you get to interact with, what are some things that you hope that they learn from you or that you hope that they take away from you after your time with them?
Well, I'm hoping that they become very good at self-reflection. And I think that, you know, we know in the expertise research that clinical experts, as they climb that ladder, are very good at self-reflection. And I'm hoping they take away that they're, you got to be humble. And you can't get everyone better.
Yeah.
But you got to figure out, hey, did I look at yourself hard? Did I miss something with this patient or this group of patients? You know, I'm hoping they can take that. I think the other thing is I hope they take away is that the clinical reasoning process, because then they can continue to grow independently regardless of what avenue they take. And I use this clinical reasoning concepts even when I was running my private practice, you know, this analyzation and self-reflection. And I think it's really, really important. And I hope also that they would make time in their careers to mentor others.
Yeah, and pass it on.
So probably a half a dozen things I hope they take away. So.
No, that's good. That's I love hearing that, because interviewing enough people, you get to hear some of the same things and different things too, but it's nice to nice to hear people in your position and your skill level and years of experience. When multiple people start to say the same stuff, you go, oh, well, that's really important.
Well, you know, I think it's a little different. And I don't want to dominate your time, but
oh, it's okay.
A little difficult in the last 4 or 5 years in mentoring is we have some very, very intelligent mentees that come in with their doctorates and they're really smart. And but I think one other thing is they have to learn to be patient. Mm-hmm. What I mean by that is you're not going to be an expert quickly. It takes time. It takes experience. And I'm just hoping that another thing they take away is that experience is valuable. And, you know, Dr. Sackett, who, you know, came up with the concepts of evidence-based medicine, the best evidence, the patient preference, and then the clinical expertise / experience. There's three components to that definition. And I strongly believe that there has to be a balance. And that's what all these people, they don't quite understand. And it takes time to from clinical experience and use of the evidence and listening to thousands and thousands of patient stories before you really feel comfortable working with people. And, you know, I was told 10 years when I was in Perth by Brian Edwards and Bob Elby. And sometimes I wonder if it's 15 to 20 years that you start feeling comfortable. But when you start feeling too comfortable and you can't handle the uncertainty of patient interaction and care, then you're not self-assessing enough. You're not self-analyzing. And that's something that we all have to really ensure our younger clinicians understand.
Yeah, in my own experience, one of the things I've noticed is right around the time that I start feeling like I'm really comfortable, I'm doing great, you know, patients are getting really, you know, a lot better, and they're achieving their goals and getting back to doing whatever they want to do. And I feel like I've got a really good grasp on the things that I'm doing. In comes another wave of patients. It's like, oh gosh, you know, what am I missing here? I can't figure this out. And it humbles you just in time. So I don't know if anybody else has that experience, but it seems to be that way for me.
You know, even on my last day in the clinic around the end of November, I felt that way, Matt, with a couple of patients. And if you lose that, it's kind of what I call an edge.
Mm-hmm.
If you lose the edge, and I don't think I lost the edge, but if you lose that thought that you just articulated about what am I missing, because it's always going to be there. There's no perfection as a clinician. I don't care how long you've been doing it. And if you think you're perfect, well, then you're probably not.
Oh, exactly.
And likewise, I have trouble with a lot of people who call themselves experts. And who's the judge that you're an expert? In
Right.
my opinion, it's your peers.
Right, exactly.
You don't go out and say, well, I'm an expert. I don't know. I still think I have a lot to learn, personally.
Yeah.
So, anyway.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
So, you mentioned on some advice previously. I have a new question I'm going to start asking people.
Sure.
What is the best and worst advice that you've heard being given to others, or even yourself?
Wow. That's a tough one. I think the best advice I've received is, and heard it many times, is kind of what we were just talking about patience, is that, you know, you're not going to get everyone better.
Yeah.
Okay. And basically that means that advice is you have to be humble, and, you know, I was talking about self-reflection. Those three things are, to me, the most important. The worst advice, wow.
Yeah, hard to pick one, I'm sure.
Yeah, I think that when I, number of years ago in 87, a few people, my wife and I were thinking about starting our own practice.
Mm-hmm.
And there was two or three people that said, oh, it's really... Back then, it was ripe for private practice. I mean, we had done our due diligence.
Mm-hmm.
And they basically said, well, you know, you can't control your own destiny very well in this healthcare arena, and it's a big risk because 80% of small businesses fail in 2 years. And I thought, well, my wife and I thought, well, that's not good advice for us because we've done our due diligence. We don't believe that.
Mm-hmm.
And we were the type of entrepreneurs at a young age that we talked to probably 50 or 60 people before we started to really get serious about starting our practice.
Wow.
So when a couple people said, oh, you're crazy to do that, we both looked at ourselves, and this is after we talked and spoken to about 50, 60 people who were in private practice, who worked for hospitals, who we did the gamut.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we left any rock unturned. And so that advice was, you won't make, don't do it, was bad advice. You know? So I guess that's it.
Well, hey, that's what
you're looking for.
No, that's good to hear. I'm not looking in for anything particular, but I am surprised to hear you say that. So that's great to hear.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think that, yeah, I think that's probably, if I really reflect back, that was some of the worst advice that two or three people gave us. And that's pretty deep stuff, in my opinion, I think.
Yeah.
Because it was challenging our business acumen and our business sense. And yeah, that's a challenge. It was a challenge.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Perfect segue, Joe. If you could challenge other people in your profession to do something, be something, change something, whatever. If you could challenge other people in your professions to something, what would you choose and why?
Well, I would say that I would challenge yourself to be a great clinician. Strive for clinical excellence. Never stop reading. Never stop self-reflecting. Never stop treating patients. And I, you know, we're a clinical profession, and you know, Matt, you're a clinician. I assume. I don't know much about you.
No, definitely.
But you're a clinician at heart. Mm-hmm. But we need to get people like yourselves also involved. You know, it sounds like, you know, you did fellowship, and, you know, you're pursuing excellence. But we need to channel that excellence into our younger people. And then we also need to channel them to be involved in the political process of the AAOMPT and get involved with, you know, committees and things of that sort, and maybe even running for office of AOMP or APTA or orthopedic section. Mm-hmm. You got to be involved, and I think what that does is it makes you, if you get involved with AOMP or orthopedic section and or APTA, you're around different people. You know, you're not going to be around the same hardcore clinicians like you are and I've been, and say your mentor, I'm sure, Greg Johnson and Vicky Johnson. Mm-hmm. You know, you're around different people and you learn from these other people a lot. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, helps you be more well-rounded as a professional. I mean, beyond patient care. But I really want to challenge our young clinicians to... And this is my bias, big bias.
Sure.
If you need to keep treating patients if you're going to be involved in a university or a residency or a fellowship.
Yeah.
Because that's why we're training people, to be very good clinicians, to, you know, and I think as we get our profession evolves, and it's really evolved immensely in the last 20 years, as it evolves, we're not going to have those stories in the New York Times that came out 10 years ago when someone interviewed five patients who went to five different physical therapists and they had five different approaches to knee pain. I mean, I'm sure you're familiar with that. But, you know, that's what we got to challenge ourselves to do is strive so that doesn't happen. Now, does that mean that we want absolute uniformity in our approaches? No. But we got to be in the same ballpark.
Yeah.
You know? So, I hope that answers your question.
No, that was perfect. Perfect. Thank you very much. From your clinical experience, Joe, this is kind of another new question. From your clinical experience and patterns that you see common across the whole gamut of patients that came in your door, if you could pick one body area, body part, body region that almost every patient would benefit from treatment there, or any type of techniques that you would like to use for that specific body region or area, where would it be?
Well, I made a living on treating spines.
Okay.
And a lot of complex chronic spine pain, and mainly lumbar spine. And I think statistically, from the last 40 years, we know that low back pain affects 80% of the working population in the Western world. Mm-hmm. So those patients really, they're expensive.
Yeah.
And what we have to be is eclectic. I don't look at a technique or, you know, that to me, in manotherapy, it's not just a technique. It relates to looking at and recognizing clinical patterns that are common with, say, chronic low back pain. Mm-hmm. And what's the best approach to treat them? Is it a combination of manual therapy and, you know, neural pain science education? You know, that's kind of the new thing on the block right now.
Yeah.
It's the new trend, right? And I've seen lots of trends in 40 years. So, you know, those kind of questions need to be answered. And I think our researchers are really starting to study that. You know, the more pragmatic approach to, say, we're talking lumbar spine, to the lumbar spine patient.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important research. And I think probably in 10 years, we're going to have some answers. We're going to need some good longitudinal studies, I believe, Matt, that looks at pragmatic approach to chronic back, we'll just say back pain.
Okay.
Because it's expensive. I mean, I don't know the dollar amounts, but it's billions spent.
Oh, yeah.
I used to have that kind of stat right at the tip of my tongue, but I don't right now.
Okay.
So.
So Along those lines, if you could teach only one thing to every patient that comes in your door, what would you choose to teach them?
How to manage their problem independently.
Perfect.
That's to me, that's the key, because, you know, I started my career in the day where reimbursement was great. You know, a doctor would refer you a patient 3 times a week for 12 weeks.
Wow.
And you get, and now you're lucky to get 8 visits. You're lucky to get 6.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've had to change our management, patient management approach quite drastically in the last, I'd say, decade. But we got to teach these people to manage themselves, and they have to also learn how to progress their exercise programs independently. And, you know, we can use, you know, email or social media to communicate with them to help them progress. And I think that's really important. It's not just you can do, you know, a rotational thrust at L4-5 and get rid of their hip pain, give them an exercise program on how to self-stretch and strengthen muscles around the spine and lower extremity, teach them how to, you know, do that, but how are they gonna progress that? And then teach them, like, when do you need me as a physical therapist or you? What are those signs and symptoms where you go, you know, I've tried what I learned from Matt or Joe and I'm not getting better? Well, then you need to contact and get in to see your physical therapist. Because, you know, say spine pain is it's like an allergy, I think. It's never cured. It's very rare.
That's a good analogy.
You have to manage spine pain. I'm just talking about that, because that's what I mainly have seen.
Sure.
If you have had 3 knee surgeries, and which included a meniscectomy and 2 ACL repairs, we got to teach you to keep strong, how to be smart in your training. And then when and how are you going to participate in sport again?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's another analogy. So you just think I treated spines.
Yeah, sure.
Another patient. But it's that self-management and independent management that to me is the real key, man.
You bring up a couple of things that made me think of a different topic, but in your experience and your education with, you know, other clinicians, do you see any trends? Are fellows in training or residents, and obviously maybe not for you guys that you're directly involved with, but other clinicians that you just see across the country, for those that are getting heavily into the manual therapy training and they're getting trained very heavily into manual therapy, do you think that there's any... I guess over-reliance on manual therapy versus basic things like how to progress a patient through an exercise program, or emphasizing exercise not enough compared to, you know, to manual therapy. Do you see anything like that, or,
you know,
any comments on that?
Yeah, I could make some comments. I think I'm not exposed with much depth to other clinicians because I don't I used to teach a lot of weekend seminars in the 80s and 90s and early 2000s, so, you know, I'd be all around the country.
Mm-hmm.
But what I do see is people that come into our fellowship from different parts of the country. Mm-hmm. And I think it's unfair to generalize whether they're good at exercise or manual therapy or not. I mean, what I see often is that clinicians aren't using the clinical reasoning process well enough to learn what manual therapy can do to get that patient out of pain and into that home exercise management regime. That, I think, is a general weakness I see around our country. Because you have the new flavor on the street is pain neuroscience education, PNE.
Yeah.
Hey, there's all this cognitive stuff we got to deal with. You know, I've seen the trends that go from Williams flexion exercises to extension to motor control, spine stabilization training. Last 5 or 8 years, there's been some great research done on thrust manipulation, joint manipulation. And so we've been through that. And now we're into this, the new flavor on the black is, you know, pain neuroscience education, PNE.
Yeah.
And we have to teach people how to be very meticulous in assessing what the patient needs. What intervention or interventions do they need to have maximized their clinical outcome? Mm-hmm. And may it be manual therapy, fine. May it be a pure exercise approach, depending on the patient's history, or may it be a pure pain neuroscience education approach based again on the patient's presentation and history, so be it.
Yeah.
But teach people how to make those assessments. And but yet, if you have a personal bias towards thrust manipulation, manual therapy, mm-hmm. or through this pain neuroeducation science, you know, neuroscience approach, well, I'm afraid that our young clinicians aren't going to experience what quote unquote passive movement treatment can do. But that's, again, that's a bias of mine, and it's probably because I've pushed mentees to say, you know, they have a chronic pain patient, a back patient.
Yeah.
They said, well, this person's got a lot of psychosocial issues. I said, well, you haven't administered a fear avoidance behavior questionnaire. How do you know that? You're guessing. They got fear. Well, okay, give me an example. What is it? And I say, my assessment is the person has a frozen shoulder. And you're talking about the pain? No, they can't reach their hand over their head. They can't.
Yeah.
They can't do their personal hygiene. You know, they got a stiff shoulder. They don't have a pain problem. They have a stiff shoulder that's stiff and painful. So yeah. How are you going to address it? And that's just one example.
That's perfect.
Anyway, probably went off on a tangent. I have a passion about clinicians, new clinicians, not being skillful and meticulous enough to do a good interview, do a good physical exam, and then use the evidence and their experience and the patient's preference to come up with a sound treatment approach, whatever it may be. And it's probably more than one or two approaches you need to utilize to get that patient better.
That's gold in and of itself, Joe. It doesn't matter whether that was a tangent or not. That was perfect to hear. That's where we get to learn the most from people in interviews or just interactions is when things are off the cuff and somebody's starting to get into a tangent of something they're really passionate about. That's when you learn a lot. So I appreciate that.
My pleasure. I kind of ranted a little bit there. Sorry.
No, fine. Well, Joe, I know we're kind of running short on our time that we spoke about, but is there anything else that we haven't, you know, brought up or spoken about that you'd like to right now?
No, I think you've been a very thorough in interviewing and some really good questions.
Okay.
I'm very appreciative, and I have more time if you do. It's up to you if you had another question or so. But this process has been very enjoyable, Matt.
Thanks.
And I applaud you for going to great efforts and help me understand. If I could ask you a question, like,
of course,
is this part of just your personal interest? Will this be like a podcast or how is this? How are you going to use these interviews of the founders, including me?
I don't really have any plans yet because with the website I started, this blog, some of it was just to kind of direct some of my pent-up energy and frustration or thoughts on many things, just direct it to something and into something so that I can, you know, not drive myself or my wife crazy. But, yeah, just to be able to do that. And then I got the thought of, well, gosh, you know, people like yourself who've been in clinical practice for so long, you're starting to retire, or you're not, not you, but some people aren't going to conferences as much as they were or being as visible as they used to be. And I think that's, I mean, that's great for those people personally, but for me, my generation, for younger people, it's a little bit of a detriment because we don't get to hear from you or we don't get to gain from all the wisdom that you guys have. So working up the gumption to actually contact people like yourself and say, hey, you know, I'm doing this little project and would you be willing to be a part of it? And that to me is the blessing. Is, I mean, so far everybody that I've asked has said, yeah, that'd be great, you know, we'd love to help with that. And yeah, that just really is a testament to all of you guys, you know, to being willing to share, you know, what you know. So,
well, I encourage you to perhaps write a paper on this or something and publish it, or you know, broadcast your podcast to, you know, IPA's fellowship program as a start or other fellowship programs, and or maybe even do a breakout at AOMP about what you found out from, you know, interviewing the founders and other you know, influential people in manual therapy. I'm sure you'll interview other people besides Ooh. The founding of the Academy or fellows.
Oh, definitely. But, I've got a long list.
I think I urge you to pursue some of those avenues.
Oh, well, thanks a lot, Joe. I really appreciate that. Joe, for listeners out there, if they want to learn more about you or the Kaiser program or anything else, any other things that you're doing, is there a place they can go to or a website, or how can they learn more about that?
They could go to the Kaiser, Northern California Kaiser Orthopedic Manual Physical Therapy website.
Okay.
You know, that'll tell them about our programs, or they could Google Northern California Educational Programs.
Mm-hmm.
Northern California Kaiser Educational Programs.
Okay.
And that'll get them into, you know, what we're doing at Kaiser. We just started an orthopedic, Dr. Eric Johnson, our director, has worked his towel off in the last year and a half. We just started an orthopedic residency program, and you know, our fellowship program continues to thrive. And so that's it. If the other thing is, my Twitter account's Joe Farrell at CPR Joe.
Mm-hmm.
And you can get my email out. It's jfarrell, F-A-R-R-E-L-L, 235@gmail.com. And I'll be glad to communicate with any clinician out there that would like, or mentee or fellow in training, residency training, DPT student. I'll answer my own emails.
Well, Joe, thanks a ton. Thanks for all your time. I mean, this has been absolutely a pleasure. So hopefully we get to run into each other really soon.
Well, I'll cherish that day. And we will.
All right, Joe. Sounds great. Thank you very much again. We'll look forward to speaking to you again soon.
Okay, and let me know what you decide to do with these great interviews that you're doing, okay?
All right, we'll do.
Okay, thanks. You take care, Matt.
All right, bye-bye.